Chapter 6 Trump for President Part 1 There are many ways to track the beginnings of Donald Trump's presidential ambitions dating back to the 1980s when he toyed with a run and started taking out full-page ads in the New York Times as a forum to air his public policy positions. In those early manifestations of Trump's aspirations, he revealed an uncanny knack for channeling the fears and resentments of the age, even as he displayed a hair-trigger approach to negotiating when he advised Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State to start talks with the Soviet Union by banging his fist on the table and shouting, "Fuck you!" Just one example was Trump's call in 1989 for the death penalty for the Central Park Five, a group of black kids convicted of the rape of a white female jogger in Manhattan's famous park. The fact that the kids were exonerated years later, when it was proven beyond doubt that they were not guilty, didn't prompt Trump to back down or admit a mistake. He'd understood instinctively that the racial anxiety and resentments then gripping New York City would provide a potent symbol that he hoped to ride to power. That was always Trump's way. Learned at the feet of Roy Cohn, his first attack dog attorney. Never apologize and never admit to error or weakness. Never, ever. Not even in the time of coronavirus, as the world would discover. In 2000, Trump again flirted with the idea of aiming for the presidency, this time as a candidate for the small and fractious Reform Party. Trump's candidacy was touted by his old friend David Pecker, a connection I would come to increasingly lean on. The Reform Party had been founded by billionaire and failed presidential candidate Ross Perot, and it lacked a coherent philosophy which actually suited Trump well, but it was constantly besieged by infighting and feuds, and the boss quickly dropped out. Ever since I signed on with the Trump Organization in 2007, I had wanted the boss to run for president, and I told him so again and again. I thought Trump was a visionary, with a no-nonsense attitude and the charisma to attract all kinds of voters. I saw many times that he had a natural ease with working-class folks, especially his fans, like those who watched The Apprentice and Celebrity Apprentice and WWE, provided they were kept at a distance. In the years since, I have asked myself why I wanted so badly for Trump to become president. I developed a slew of answers and justifications over time. I thought he would rise to the office and it would bring out the best in him. I thought his brand of straight talk and no bullshit honesty would rid the country of the scourge of political correctness. I thought his business acumen and way of seeing the world would offer a bracing change for the country and help fix our failing infrastructure. I thought his America First political stance would make the country stronger, and I thought his original and unique approaches to trade and taxes would transform society for the good. I thought his aversion to the nonstop, unending wars in the Middle East would restore sanity to foreign policy. Those were the things I told myself as I nagged and wheedled and tried to convince him to take the idea of running for the White House seriously. I knew he was a liar and a master manipulator, along with the myriad less-than-sterling characteristics I had witnessed over the years, but I believed his positive qualities outweighed the downsides, and perfection shouldn't be the enemy of good. But here's the ugly truth. A motive I share with deep and abiding regret and shame, and one only unearthed after much soul-searching and reflection as I painted the walls in prison and stared at the ceiling from my bunk. The real, real truth about why I wanted Trump to be president was because I wanted the power that he would bring to me. I wanted to be able to crush my enemies and rule the world. I know it sounds crazy. But look at what Trump is doing now, running the world, into the ground, but still, he literally rules. Underneath all the layers of delusion and wishful thinking and willful ignorance and stupidity, I was like Gollum in The Lord of the Rings, lusting after the power that would come from possessing the White House, my precious. and I was more than willing to lie, cheat, and bully to win. Trump was the only person I had ever encountered who I believed could actually pull off that feat. And I recognized early the raw talent and charisma and pure ruthless ambition to succeed he possessed. I saw what others didn't, what others thought was a joke at their own peril, and that was my true motive. I knew Trump would do whatever was necessary to win. I just lacked the imagination and moral purpose to actually think about what that would mean for America, the world, for me, and for my family. Because here's the thing. When you sell your soul, you do exactly that. Sell your soul. Although I never heard Trump use the N-word in my time spent with him, there were many times that he made racist comments. What he said in private was far worse than what he uttered in public. As an example, in September 2008, we were in Chicago for the topping-off ceremony for the Trump International Hotel and Tower. Bill Rancic, who had won the first season of The Apprentice 4 years before, had been put in charge of the project. Trump reminisced to me about Rancic, who had been in a head-to-head with another contestant, Kwame Jackson. Kwame was not only a nice guy, but also a brilliant Harvard MBA graduate. Trump was explaining his back and forth about not picking Kwame. "There was no way I was going to let this black fag win," he said to me. The election of 2008 was a cataclysm for Trump as he watched a young African-American senator from Illinois defeat first Hillary Clinton and then John McCain. Barack Obama's victory, in many ways, was the defining event of Donald Trump's rise. There were really no words to describe Trump's hatred and contempt for Barack Hussein Obama, always all three names and always with a disdainful emphasis on the middle. This was when I started to witness the increasingly reactionary and unhinged Archie Bunker racism that defined Trump and his views on modern America. He was friendly with many African-American people, pretty much exclusively of the celebrity variety. Of course, Trump really had no friends, only interests and desires and ambitions, and he wasn't so stupid as to use the N-word, at least not in my presence. Mike Tyson, Don King, Oprah, those were the black folks he admired and embraced. Rich, famous, part of the peer group he inhabited. But as a rule, Trump expressed low opinions of all black folks, from music to culture and politics. Africa was a hellhole, he believed, and Nelson Mandela, to use but one example, was an object of contempt for Trump. "Tell me one country run by a black person that isn't a shithole," he would challenge me as he cursed out the stupidity of Obama. "They are all complete fucking toilets." When Mandela passed away years later, Trump told me he didn't think the South African founding father and national hero was a real leader, not the kind he respected. "South Africa was once a beautiful country 20, 30 years ago," Trump said, endorsing apartheid-era white rule. "Mandela fucked the whole country up. Now it's a shithole. Fuck Mandela. He was no leader." Don't ask me how I squared this kind of racism with his qualifications to be president. I wanted power, as I've confessed, and that blinded me to just about everything awful and true and dangerous about Trump. My precious. Watching Obama's inauguration in 2008 with Trump, with the massive, adoring, joyful crowd on the Mall, incensed the boss in a way I'd never seen before. He was literally losing his mind watching a handsome and self-evidently brilliant young black man take over, not only as commander-in-chief, but also as a moral world leader and guiding light. It was just too much for Trump. I thought I'd seen the worst of Trump then, but when Obama won the Nobel Prize, Trump went ballistic, as if the universe were playing some kind of trick on him to drive him out of his mind. It was almost like he was hearing voices, the way he ranted and raved about the idiotic Obama and how he was beloved by so many Americans. Trump mocked the way Obama talked, walked, even appeared, as if acting presidential was just that, an act. The shtick you see him pull at his rallies when he mocks the idea of being presidential and says how easy it is to pretend to be a serious leader, walking like a robot and marching around like a fool and a phony, was first performed for yours truly in Trump's office while I sat quietly listening to him go on and on and on about Obama and caricature his mannerisms. We even hired a faux-bama, or fake Obama, to record a video where Trump ritualistically belittled the first black president and then fired him, a kind of fantasy fulfillment that it was hard to imagine any adult would spend serious money living out, until he did the functional equivalent in the real world. Trump didn't despise Obama. It was much, much stronger than that. I figured that Obama was the only person on the planet whom Trump actually envied, truly, madly, deeply. Air Force One, walking the carpet to deliver the State of the Union, the way Angela Merkel and other world leaders obviously admired and listened to Obama, it drove Trump out of his mind. Then came the speech. Obama was invited to address the German nation in front of the Brandenburg Gate in the same place as John F. Kennedy in the early 60s, one of the indelible images of American history in the 20th century. Trump went from incandescent to sputtering, spittle-flecked fury as he watched Obama talk about freedom and ridding the world of nuclear weapons and turning back the rising seas by fighting global warming. You've got to admit, he's a great orator, I said. Fuck him, Trump yelled at me, Obama on the screen before him, calmly addressing untold millions of Germans, thrilled to have a world leader ushering in the prospect of a 21st century where diversity and tolerance and peace and responsibility would become global aspirations and maybe even realities. He's obviously very smart, I said, knowing I was egging Trump on, but also honestly impressed by Obama's speech and demeanor. Obama is a fucking phony, Trump screamed. He's a Manchurian candidate. He's not even fucking American. The only reason he got into fucking Harvard Law School in Columbia was fucking affirmative action. He could never get into those schools on his fucking grades. Fuck him. Here is the true story behind Trump's first serious attempt to run for president and avenge the cosmic injustice that Barack Obama represented to him. In 2011, as always, part of my daily duties was to scour the newspapers for mentions of Trump, in large part to satiate his insatiable ego. And I undertook this responsibility with real pleasure and energy, especially hunting for signs that Trump's political fortunes might be making news or causing speculations about the boss running for higher office. The prospect of a Trump candidacy was being promoted by the ever-eager and ingratiating David Pecker in the National Enquirer, but there were very few signs that the mainstream media was taking the idea seriously. Then, in mid-April of 2011, public policy polling released an opinion survey that stunned me as I read it sitting at my desk first thing in the morning. Barack Obama was up for re-election the following year, and speculation was circulating about potential candidates for the Republican nomination. The obvious leading contenders were Mitt Romney and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, but both seemed like lame choices to me. I thought Trump could eat them for breakfast, if he really committed to the campaign. The public policy poll that day had the amazing result that 26% of GOP primary voters said they would support Trump from among a slate of Republican candidates that included his name. I immediately grasped the implications as I clipped the story from the newspaper and readied it to bring to the boss's attention the moment he arrived at work. I knew that Trump would want to discuss the poll, not just with me and his kids, but with anyone who entered his office or spoke to him on the phone. When Trump was ego surfing, no one was exempt from his need for praise and admiration. Trump arrived in the office soon after, and I instantly walked the short distance to his office. I knocked on the door and entered. "Hey, boss, you have to see this," I said. I proudly handed him the clip and took a seat in my usual middle egg chair. "No shit," Trump said, scanning the article, his face forming into a priceless expression, partly amazement, partly delight, partly disbelief, but mostly a kind of transcendent vindication, as if he'd known the truth all along. "Wow," he said, reading on. "Michael, what do you make of this?" "It's tremendous, boss," I said. 26% is unprecedented. You aren't even a politician or even someone with political inclinations." Trump finished the article and leaned back in his oversized, overstuffed burgundy executive chair, contemplating. "What do you think about doing it?" he asked. "Doing what?" I asked. "Let's do it," Trump said. "Shit, I've done everything else. Why not? I'm bored with buildings, golf, and television. Being president would be very cool." Trump was now in a reverie, imagining the possibilities in a way I'd never seen before. His enthusiasm was infectious, and my mind was also racing as I imagined a real Trump campaign, with me as a central part of the operation. "Take a look at how to make this happen," Trump said to me. "I'm serious. I want to do this. It's perfect timing. I've got age, wealth, notoriety. I can do the job much better than Barack Hussein Obama, that's for fucking sure. Michael, go figure this out. What's the worst that happens? We lose? So what? This can be the greatest infomercial in the history of politics." Trump smiled at the thought of the win-win proposition he uniquely possessed. The inevitable wall-to-wall ink and airtime his candidacy would command would translate into one giant, free, ongoing advertisement. The logic was genius, he and I both knew, our grins spreading. "And the best result is that we win," Trump said. "Now that would be something." The "we" Trump was referring to was himself, of course, as he drifted into a reverie, his eyes taking on the 1,000-yard stare that I would see in action 4 years hence. I could see he was imagining walking into the White House, sitting down in the Oval Office, taking over as Commander-in-Chief. I would have the Marine Corps band play "Hail to the Chief" every morning as I got out of bed, Trump said. How did Donald Trump come to command 26% of Republican voters in the spring of 2011? The short answer, the only honest response to that question, was one word: birtherism. I know because I witnessed it unfold from the inside. As a way to test the waters in the weeks before the poll, the boss gave a speech to the Conservative Political Action Conference in February of 2011, and that was his coming out party. In the address, Trump ticked off all of the conservative boxes: pro-gun, anti-abortion, low taxes, ready to wage a trade war with China. But his signature credential was his promise to make America great again. The room was packed for the speech as he received huge applause, and it was well received in the right-leaning press. The media, restless with an uninspiring list of candidates like Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich. Trump was a fresh face, a reality TV celebrity with a bombastic reputation. A matchup with his arch-nemesis Barack Obama would be epic. It was obvious, and killer for ratings. To liberals at the time, the idea of Trump running for president was literally a joke, and leading pollsters and pundits said so again and again in magazines like The Atlantic. But Trump was five steps ahead of the mainstream media, I knew, as the Trump Organization engaged with the producers of the forthcoming Comedy Central Roast of Donald Trump. The boss had approval over all the jokes for the roast, and he didn't really care how he was made fun of, with a few specific and very important provisos. No one was to mock his wealth, his various bankruptcies, or his hair. Those subjects were strictly out of bounds, I knew, as I parsed the script on his behalf, and a script it was, with every joke vetted and requiring final approval by me. The Trump roast was the perfect vehicle for his campaign, a judo-like way for the boss to both embrace and deflect the supposedly hilarious idea that he would become commander-in-chief. By sitting on a stage while he was being ridiculed, Trump would prove that he could take a joke, even if he very rarely laughed. In fact, he almost never laughed, unless it was at a crude sexual comment or at someone else's misfortune. After reviewing the proposed gags, I'd sit and watch him work over the material with his giant Sharpie, essentially dictating how the evening would play out. Trump had been roasted before at the Friars Club in New York City in 2004, a comedy club I belonged to, but I didn't attend that event. I knew there had been some great zingers at that roast. The reason Trump puts his name on all his buildings is so the banks know which ones to take back, said a comedian named Rich Voss. The comic Stewie Stone said he'd read Trump's book on how to become a billionaire and he enjoyed it. But if your father wasn't one first, you'd be a waiter in this hotel, he said. At the time, Trump was engaged to Melania Noss, as she was then known, prompting the president of NBC, Jeff Zucker, to apologize for not being able to make it to the wedding. But I'll catch the next one, he said. Comedy Central aired the Trump roast on March 8, 2011, with Trump entering on a gilded gold golf cart and taking to the dais with a mostly B-list group of celebrities, including Snoop Dogg, Larry King, and the usual comedians hired to skewer celebrities. Finding stars willing to participate had proven difficult, even among some of Trump's supposed friends, like Mike Tyson and Don King. I guess they didn't want to associate themselves with a man pushing a conspiracy theory about President Obama's place of birth. The term birtherism didn't exist in the mainstream media in 2011, not until the boss took it up. For years, conspiracy theorists had speculated about Obama's birthplace, claiming it was Kenya, not Hawaii, despite the absence of evidence to support the allegation. The idea that the President of the United States wasn't American was unprecedented, the kind of scurrilous insinuation that was transparently racist and nativist in nature. But Donald Trump recognized a great marketing opportunity when he saw one. I don't know how he picked up on the idea, other than browsing in the press as he always did, but like an old-time carnival barker, really like the greatest showman and promoter of all time, P.T. Barnum, Trump recognized the potential instinctively. No matter what anyone says, including Trump, I know for a fact that he didn't care if the conspiracy theory was true or not. He didn't care where Obama had been born or the insult it was to the president and his family, let alone the crude racism lurking barely below the surface. What he cared about was identifying an issue that he could exploit to his advantage, no matter how divisive. In fact, the more divisive, the better, because it would arouse strong feelings for those who took his side. The same was true for Trump's preposterous claim that he had seen Arabs in New Jersey celebrating on September 11, 2001, as the World Trade Centers collapsed after the terror attack masterminded by Osama bin Laden. Trump didn't see any such celebration, obviously, nor did such a ghoulish and disgusting spectacle ever occur, it goes without saying. But Trump had the innate ability to access the deepest prejudices and fears of people and exploit them for his benefit. He divided the world into us versus them, mainlining the most emotional and irrational impulses of the masses, with Arabs and Syrian refugees and the slaughter of the Kurds. He abandoned the truth in favor of falsehoods, which he knew perfectly well were false, in exchange for news cycle sound bites. And the media has fallen for it over and over and over to this day and beyond. Birtherism was one of Trump's most successful early big lie gambits. The pattern I had witnessed so many times began to emerge, as his mind quickly traveled from naked and shameless exploitation of the birther conspiracy theory to the conviction that it was true. If Trump wanted to believe something because it served his purposes, he decided to begin to believe, a leap of the imagination that was effortless to him, even second nature. What started as a ratings extravaganza morphed into self-delusion before my eyes. The first step along the path was accumulating positive reinforcement, and Trump accomplished this by calling in executives and friends and asking them a simple question. You don't think Barack Hussein Obama was born in America, do you? It was obvious from the way Trump asked the question what answer he wanted, and I was stunned to see how many people were willing to feed into the boss's personal animosity for Obama. To spread his new marketing ploy, Trump appeared on Good Morning America in March of 2011, and that was when his name really entered the national conversation about the presidency. He said he was skeptical about Obama's citizenship and birthplace, hence legitimacy as president, and they gave him the airtime to spread that nastiness. Even better, for free. This was quickly followed by appearances on The View and CNN Newsroom, and then in April on NBC. The polls started to register Trump as a potential candidate, and I started to clip newspaper stories to show him, culminating in the public policy result with the boss at 26%. But that wasn't all there was to it. As events moved along, the story Trump was pushing took on another dimension. Not only was Obama not American, he wasn't even Christian, the boss told me. By then, Trump was reading what he called the populist publications like Breitbart and World News every day as he lectured me about the truth of world affairs, the tales getting taller all the time. Do you think Barack Hussein Obama was born in Hawaii? Trump asked me one day that spring. Bullshit. There is no record of his birth in a Hawaiian hospital. You know he's not even fucking Christian. He's a Muslim. He admitted it. I was sitting in my red egg chair when Trump handed me a document purporting to be from the Harvard Law Review, stating in a biography that he had been born in Kenya. I can't explain why the bio states that, I said, but I'm certain he was born in Hawaii. There is no way the Clinton machine would not have uncovered that if it was true, because... Trump interrupted me mid-sentence. Bullshit, he said. He's a fraud. He's a Manchurian candidate. You'll see. Well, if you're right, that would create the most difficult situation in American history, I replied. Every bill passed and signed by him would have to be repealed as invalid and unlawful. It would be a complete clusterfuck. As he listened, Trump's eyes lit up. He'd come up with an idea. He looked at me with glee as he picked up the phone and dialed one of his favorite reporters. I knew he was going to drop a headline-making bombshell, and the gullible reporter would have no clue that he or she was being played. This is a little-appreciated fact about his path to power. He screams about fake news and reporters being the enemies of the people like a tin pot dictator, but the truth was that the media's psychotic fascination with Trump was one of the biggest, maybe the biggest cause for his rise to power. I have a team of investigators in Hawaii and elsewhere obtaining proof of Obama's birth in Kenya, Trump told the reporter from the National Enquirer. The journalist was like a moth to the flame. And I knew what that felt like. The conversation was on speakerphone, so I heard him beg for more sensational leads, all the better to please his boss at the National Enquirer, David Pecker. Tell me more, the reporter said. What agency are you using? What have they found? Are they in Hawaii and Kenya? What can you share? Nothing yet, Trump said, but soon I will make a major announcement of the findings, and trust me, you will be shocked. Can I get an exclusive on this when you're ready? The reporter asked. Sure, Trump said. You've been good to me. Just keep reporting that way and I will give it to you. Trump hung up. We don't have anyone in Hawaii that I know of, I said. Do you want me to put someone on that? No, Trump replied. Who fucking cares? Wait until the headlines come out. This story is going to be huge. He then gave me an earnest stare and exhorted me to handle the press with caution. I was his partner in crime, metaphorically speaking, and he wanted to ensure that I understood what to do next. The question of whether I would knowingly participate in a lie and a fraud had long ago been asked and answered. This was what Trump meant by loyalty, and what is still playing out nightly on the news as the vice president and cabinet members repeat things they know not to be true. "Make sure that you stay on message when we get calls from other media outlets," Trump said. "We have a team of people in Hawaii, and soon Trump will be making a statement on the results. Got it?" "Yes, sir," I said. Within days, my phone was lit up with calls from the New York Times, Washington Post, the networks, Fox, CNN, you name it. All the free publicity we wanted, courtesy of the free press. The reporters begged me for a scoop, no matter how small, a way to advance the story even an inch, to own a tiny piece of the news cycle. "On background," they pled, "off the record, off the record. Please tell me more, anything at all. Please, please, please." As instructed by the boss, I replied as I'd been told to. "Mr. Trump will release the findings from his investigative team very soon." The headlines were soon bannered across the nation, along with op-eds condemning Trump's allegations, just more publicity as far as the boss was concerned. Why did I go along with this ridiculous and racist attack? Why did the press? The truth was that I didn't just passively not protest Trump's transparently false accusations against Obama. I actively, rabidly, incessantly, insistently repeated the lies and innuendo, knowing in my heart that it was wrong, but unable to stop myself. I know that's not much of an explanation. I know it sounds like a cop-out and hardly the most likable trait a man might offer in his defense. But that is what it feels like to lose control of your mind. You actually give up your common sense, sense of decency, sensitivity, even your grip on reality. It was like having a mental illness. The reality was hard for outsiders to grasp in all of its dimensions. The fact that I'd departed from reality in my desire to please the boss meant that I really and truly had actually taken leave of my senses. As I said at the start, I was in a cult of personality. And I loved it. I reveled in the intrigue and gamesmanship and manipulation, as terrible as that sounds. I had convinced myself I was in on the joke with the boss, but in truth, the real joke was on me. After every call, I'd go to Trump's office and tell him about the network or publication that had reached out. Trump was thrilled. "I told you this would be a monster story," Trump told me. "Fuck Obama. If you think he hates me now, just wait." The lengths to which Trump would go to goad Obama had no bottom, as I saw when Trump started questioning his academic record, making it appear that the president had been the beneficiary of affirmative action instead of a brilliant student who had been the first black editor-in-chief of the Harvard Law Review and graduated magna cum laude, especially as compared to the boss's mediocre record as a student. When cries emerged to see Trump's academic record, it was obvious to the boss that he was in real trouble. He'd called Obama a terrible student and demanded that he release his transcripts. But what if Trump's grades at the New York Military Academy High School, Fordham, and the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania were released? As the controversy erupted, Trump called me into his office and tasked me with putting out a fire of his own creation. He didn't say why. He never did. He told me what he wanted done, even though it was as plain as the nose on my face that he wanted his academic record suppressed because he was a middling student at best, but it remained unspoken. I was pretty sure there would also be a history of disciplinary action in the record, which would further embarrass the boss to the extent that was possible. To placate Trump, I contacted the upstate New York Military Academy, where he'd been sent by his parents as a teenager to instill some sense of discipline, and explained that all hell would break loose if they didn't immediately provide me with all of the boss's high school academic records. I didn't ask nicely. I was blunt and brutal, as usual when on a mission for the boss. The pressure was jacked up by using wealthy alumni to pressure the school, forcing the headmaster to scurry into the basement and remove the documents, another unprecedented event. That was Trump when it came to Obama. Competitive, but in many ways afraid of actually being compared, even though he would ridicule any suggestion that he was intimidated by the president. The White House Correspondents' Dinner was held in late April of 2011 in Washington, D.C. I chose not to go, but I watched from home as President Obama took to the podium in front of hundreds of reporters and celebrities to join in the annual political joke fest. I knew the boss was in the crowd as the guest of Lolly Weymouth, daughter of the legendary Washington Post owner Katherine Graham, and it was easy to spot Trump's orange coif sticking out like a sore thumb in the sea of tuxedos and formal dresses, especially when Obama began to rip into the Celebrity Apprentice star by mocking his presidential aspirations. Obama had released his long-form birth certificate a few days before, telling supporters that he was trying to put the controversy to rest and remind voters that politics wasn't a reality TV show, an obvious dig at Trump. But the boss wasn't going to let the show end that easily. Life was indeed a reality TV show to Trump. The boss had turned the spurious allegation into a real political force, with 40% of Republican voters by then believing that Obama hadn't been born in the United States. So the release of the birth certificate wasn't going to deter him. Trump had identified his base, I knew, and he viewed the release of the birth certificates as a triumph, not the end of the matter. Unknown to the world, only a few hours earlier, Obama had ordered the operation to kill Osama bin Laden, so the fact that the president had such incredible comedic chops was amazing to me. Now, I know that he's taken some flack lately, but no one is happier, no one is prouder, to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald, Obama said. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter, like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell? And where are Biggie and Tupac? But all kidding aside, obviously, we all know about your credentials and breadth of experience. For example, just recently, in an episode of Celebrity Apprentice, at the steakhouse, the men's cooking team did not impress the judges from Omaha Steaks. And there was a lot of blame to go around. But you, Mr. Trump, recognized that the real problem was a lack of leadership. And so ultimately, you didn't blame Lil Jon or Meatloaf. You fired Gary Busey. And these are the kinds of decisions that would keep me up at night. Well handled, sir. Well handled. The room exploded with laughter as the celebrities turned to catch a glimpse of the reddening face of Trump. Many in the media have speculated that his animus for Obama came from that night, the humiliation in front of a room of power players, and was what made Trump want to run for the presidency. I can tell you with absolute certainty that wasn't true, not even in the slightest. He hated Obama long before then. The hatred that would animate him in the years to come needed no further fire. But it did seal Trump's resolve to run, I thought. To take the temperature in Iowa, the boss and I agreed that I should fly out to Des Moines to meet with the leaders of the GOP. But because of my schedule, it wasn't going to be possible for me to take commercial flights. For the first time ever, to my knowledge, including with Trump's kids, the boss suggested that I use his 727 for the one-man trip. Even that came with an asterisk, though, because the 727 was up for sale and the new 757 was going to be delivered soon, so I wasn't getting the true gilded treatment he reserved for himself. The cost of the flight was likely a campaign contribution violation, even though we didn't really even have a campaign at the time. We got around the pesky federal election laws as we usually did, by way of deceit. In this case, we used our go-to front, or beard, when Trump and I were hiding the true nature of our activities, a man by the name of Stuart Rahr. Universally known and loved as Stewie Rah-Rah in wealthy New York circles, he was a pharmaceutical billionaire who'd divorced his wife of many years in the throes of a midlife crisis and turned himself into a party animal and big-time playboy, at least as much as a man in his late 60s could manage, and he managed very well. Rah-Rah was the straw man I would use to buy a portrait of Mr. Trump that was up for sale at an art auction in the Hamptons a couple of years later. With Trump, everything had to be the biggest and the best, most especially his public profile, and that included a 9-foot-tall portrait of Trump painted by the artist William Quigley. When the Trump portrait came up for auction, Rah-Rah kept bidding the price up, with the final bang of the gavel coming in at $60,000, a ridiculously high price for the run-of-the-mill portrait, but it was the highest price paid at the event, giving the boss bragging rights. And that was all he cared about. To reimburse Rah-Rah for the painting, Trump arranged for his charity, the Trump Foundation, to cut him a check, using the charitable tax deduction as a way to reduce the cost of the portrait. This was typical of Trump's method of accounting and evading taxes. He had no regard for the niceties of actually doing real charitable work or following tax laws. The giant, smiling image of self-regard was then hung in Trump's Doral Golf Club, proving that it had exactly zero benefit for any charitable cause, but again, that was par for the course for the boss. Little people pay taxes, as Leona Helmsley, another wealthy New York real estate figure who committed the crime of telling the truth, once remarked. In the end, the Trumps would have to repay the back taxes on the painting, along with a substantial fine, and close the charity down when the New York Attorney General brought a case against the family for using the so-called foundation as a sham. But justice delayed was justice denied in this case, as he successfully hid the venal truth from the world long enough to become president. For the private flight on Trump's plane, I had Rah-Rah pay the cost to be reimbursed by Trump eventually, a type of under-the-table back-scratching common for the true elite. But when another candidate complained to the Federal Election Commission, the leading Republican lawyer governing the agency, an attorney named Don McGahn, cut off the investigation, proving his loyalty and usefulness to Trump, which would be rewarded when he was appointed White House counsel after the boss won the election of 2016. Landing in Des Moines in the Trump-branded jet, I was greeted by scores of reporters waiting in the hangar. I did a press conference, of course. The most dangerous place in America was in between me and a camera, especially if I was extolling the virtues of the boss. The head of the Republican Party had arranged a tight schedule for me with 15-minute meetings stacked on top of each other, but the universal response was enthusiasm for a Trump candidacy. There was a $100-a-head lunch fundraiser, which was packed, and I offered the keynote address, relishing the chance to speak in public. I raved about Trump's love for the wide-open spaces of Middle America and the prairie states of Red America. But nothing could have been further from the truth. Trump couldn't locate Iowa on a map any more than he could tell the difference between the locations of Kansas and Kansas City. I gave the boss the download when I flew home and took his call late at night, as usual, his last call of the day. "Tell me, what was the reception like in Iowa?" he asked. "Off the charts," I said. "You can't imagine all the clamoring." "Tell Melania," Trump said, passing the phone to his wife. I gave her the whole spiel about the press and the lunch and the crowds, but I could tell she wasn't interested. She wasn't disrespectful, just disinterested, and eager to get off the phone so she wouldn't have to listen to her husband's chief enabler sing his praises. "That's great," she said, and click, she was gone. To promote Trump's run in 2012, I set up a website called shouldtrumprun.com, and soon it was getting hits. This was when Roger Stone came into the picture. Trump and Stone had met years earlier when both were moving in Roy Cohn's libertine circles in the nightclubs of Manhattan. Stone was a longtime political consultant, or more like a political conspiracy monger who'd worked for Richard Nixon and had a giant tattoo of the disgraced president on his back. Stone turned up at the office wearing tiny black sunglasses and a broad-shouldered suit, his hair slicked back, and affecting the strut of a cartoon character or a clown playing one. I was taking a crash course in political campaigns with folks like Chris Ruddy at Newsmax and reporters at the Des Moines Register, sharing their contacts and insights as I worked the phones. The vibe between Stone and me was instantly not good. Stone was a sycophant to Trump, but he and I had an instant dislike for each other. Part of it was personal style. Stone was a braggart and bully, and he wanted to dominate Trump's attention. Traits in direct conflict with my role as the boss's tough guy. So part of it was also structural. Trump didn't take sides in our feud, but he ridiculed Stone behind his back, as he did most everyone, including me, no doubt. The boss had no concern for the morality or sexual conduct of his acolytes or team members like Roger Stone, a swinger known for wearing assless chaps during the gay pride parade in Manhattan. Trump joked about Stone and what a crazy person he was, devoid of moral purpose and willing to do anything in service of himself or a politician he supported, always and only because it would benefit him personally. To Trump, those were good qualities to possess. "Roger's a fucking pervert," Trump said to me. "But he can help me. He's the dirty trickster. He's the best trickster money can buy." So how did the amoral Trump come to be beloved by evangelical voters? A question that remains one of the abiding mysteries to this day? Begin with the premise that Donald Trump hadn't darkened the door of a church or chapel since the age of 7, as he would openly admit in his past incarnation. Places of religious worship held absolutely no interest to him, and he possessed precisely zero personal piety in his life. But he knew the power of religion, and that was a language he could speak. I lived in Trump Park Avenue, and one of my neighbors was an evangelical pastor named Paula White. She had known Trump for more than a decade after he'd seen her show on TV and he'd invited her to come to Atlantic City to give him private Bible studies, her version of prosperity gospel, the only conceivable version of Christianity that could appeal to Trump. Self-interested, consumed by the lust for worldly wealth and rewards, with 2 divorces, 1 bankruptcy, and a Senate financial investigation, she was a preacher after Trump's heart. The fact that she was beautiful and blonde didn't hurt either. As part of the division of labor in the campaign, I was assigned to lead the outreach to faith communities on behalf of Trump, mostly because having Roger Stone attempt to make those connections would be a farce. It was at this time that Paula White called me and said she wanted to put together a group of evangelical leaders to meet with Trump to discuss his potential candidacy and the spiritual and political dimensions of his campaign. The idea was for Trump to solicit their support, so I readily agreed to help put the session together. More than 50 religious leaders came to Trump Tower to meet the boss in a conference room on the 25th floor. Some of the most famous evangelicals in the country were there, like Jerry Falwell Jr., Pastor Daryl Scott, and Dr. Creflo Dollar, an Atlanta preacher who would later be charged with choking his daughter and ridiculed for soliciting contributions from his parishioners so he could purchase a $65 million Falcon 7X private jet to safely and swiftly share the good news of the gospel worldwide. As an organizer, I went to watch the proceedings, and what I saw was amazing, to put it mildly. Sitting around the long conference room table, the group started to discuss Trump's 3 marriages, his views on abortion, homosexuality, family values, America's role in the world, and God's place in the boss's heart. As a little kid, Trump's family had attended Marble Collegiate Church in Manhattan, where he listened to the sermons of Norman Vincent Peale. The Protestant preacher was the author of The Power of Positive Thinking and an early radio and television star sermonizing about the materialistic advantages of American conservative religion, making him a hero to the folks meeting with Trump as a pioneer in blending or conflating wealth and Jesus in a way that somehow found the Son of God was all about the bling. Trump milked the Norman Peale connection like a dairy farmer at dawn, not letting one drop spill. Peale's version of God's word revolved around tall tales he told that were completely unverifiable and calling for the banishment of thoughts or emotions that were negative, which must have penetrated young Donnie Trump's consciousness as a boy. Trump always lived in the present tense. He never looked backwards except in anger or to blame others, which was part of Peale's appeal to his followers. When Trump was sitting in the pews as a boy, Peale was one of the most famous pastors in the world, which had to impress the kid. But it was likely the cult-like egomania that he urged Christians to follow that seemed to have penetrated little Donnie's impressionable brain, no doubt reinforced by his taskmaster father and hyper-ambitious mother. As the evangelicals inhaled Trump's Norman Peale horseshit, they solemnly asked to approach him to lay hands on him. I watched with bated breath. Trump was a massive germaphobe, as I've noted, so the idea of dozens of sets of hands touching his clothing and skin would appall him, I knew. But even this didn't faze the boss. He closed his eyes, faking piety, and gave the appearance of feeling God's presence as the assembled group called for guidance in determining the fate and fortune of Donald Trump, America, and the message of Jesus Christ. If you knew Trump as I did, the vulgarian salivating over beauty contestants, or mocking Roger Stone's propensity for desiring the male sexual organ in his mouth, as he would say less politely, you would have a hard time keeping a straight face at the sight of him affecting the serious and pious mien of a man of faith. I know I could hardly believe the performance or the fact that these folks were buying it. Watching Trump, I could see that he knew exactly how to appeal to the evangelicals' desires and vanities, who they wanted him to be, not who he really was. Everything he was telling them about himself was absolutely untrue. He was pro-abortion. He told me that Planned Parenthood was the way poor people paid for contraception. He didn't care about religion. Homosexuals, divorce, the breakup of the nuclear family. He'd say whatever they wanted to hear, and they'd hear what they wanted to hear. This was the moment for me. The split second when I knew Trump would be president one day. It was an intuition, but it was also based on the intangibles. Trump's answers to their questions were compassionate, thoughtful, godly, in a way that I knew in no way reflected his beliefs or a way of seeing life. He could lie directly to the faces of some of the most powerful religious leaders in the country, and they believed him. Or decided to believe him, a distinction with a real difference. Trump was imperfect, they knew, with his multiple marriages and carefully cultivated reputation as a womanizer. But he knew what they really cared about, the core beliefs. Anti-abortion laws, Supreme Court justices, opposition to gay marriage and civil rights, and the culture-warlike rhetoric aimed at godless liberals. That was Trump's rat-like cunning, and it was a talent I knew then that he would ride all the way to the White House. The prayer over, Trump opened his eyes as if he had indeed been in deep meditation and conversation with God. "What do you think about me running for president?" Trump asked Pastor White in a reverent tone. There was a silence in the room as bowed heads were raised and eyes opened. This was no longer a question about the ambitions of a billionaire celebrity. It was about the soul of the nation. The Almighty was being summoned to guide the faithful. Paula White was very serious as she talked in a low voice, addressing the assembled in a passionate but measured way, Trump listening with yet more fake piety. "I don't think the time is right," she replied slowly. "I don't either," Trump said, also slowly, carefully, and thoughtfully. As the two-hour session broke up, another event took place that would come to have a huge impact on the 2016 election, whether God wanted it or not. The genesis of this momentous moment, as you'll hear in the pages to come, was my first meeting with Jerry and Becky Falwell and the implications it would have on the future of America. With folks milling around in the hallway of Trump Tower, I fell into a conversation with the couple that would provide the first flutter of a wave to the butterfly wing flapping that rippled outward and led to the devout and undying devotion to Trump of millions of evangelicals that still mystifies so many Americans. Justin Bieber was the catalyst. Go figure. Jerry Falwell Jr. was a lot like me in many ways, I thought. An attorney who didn't practice law, a transaction-oriented person who lived in the real world, even as he floated through a kind of dreamy existence of wealth and power, in his case, evangelical royalty, in mine, the moneyed corridors of Trump's Manhattan. Becky was beautiful and vivacious, with a ton of energy and life. Chatting, they told me that they were staying in New York for an extra day because their 12-year-old daughter Caroline wanted to see Justin Bieber perform at a special show he was giving the next morning at Rockefeller Plaza for NBC's Today Show. "Oh God, it's going to be a complete madhouse," Jerry said. "The things we do for our children." "As I would do for mine," I replied. My daughter Samantha was a little older, but I would have moved heaven and earth to give her the kind of thrill that the Falwells were seeking. This presented an ideal opening for a fixer like me, I realized. I'm not sure if I can pull it off, but a close friend of mine is an executive at Bieber's record label, I continued. Let me call him and see if I can get you into the VIP area and possibly get a meet and greet. Becky's eyes lit up, like I'd offered her the chance to be a superstar in her daughter's eyes, and who wouldn't want to be that for their tween? "Michael, thank you for even offering to try," she said. Becky offered me a hug and peck on the cheek as we swapped cell numbers, and I told them I'd call as soon as I had news. This was the kind of thing I was put on earth to do, to be honest about my real role in Trump's circle, but also, more broadly, in my life. Doing favors, making connections, working my Rolodex. That was me. Figuring out how to give the Falwell's daughter a lifetime memory. Not knowing where it would lead, but knowing it was likely going to be somewhere. Back in my office, I called my buddy and asked for 3 tickets to the VIP area for the Bieber concert the next morning, along with the possible chance to actually meet the cherubic Canadian in person. My pal was good with the tickets, but said it would be harder to swing the personal introduction. He said he'd try. The notice was short and the demand was huge, and he didn't want to get my hopes up, so I didn't tell the Falwells about that possibility, instead calling them and saying they were good to go on the tickets. I knew my friend would be there to take great care of them, so that was all excellent, and the Falwells were beyond excited to tell their daughter she was going to have a first-class seat at the show only a few feet from her idol. Heady stuff. "I can't thank you enough," Jerry said as I gave him directions on where to report for the tickets. "You made this trip even better than it already was. We're friends for life." The impact this tiny favor would have on the world was the furthest thing from my mind. But it would indeed come to matter, in the way random events multiply to form a pattern that can be seen to have real importance in hindsight. Part of the art to being a fixer, doing small and big things for people, was never, ever asking for anything in return. For myself, that is. For others, I was more than happy to call in a chit or IOU or however you want to describe the sense of obligation that comes from granting your tween daughter her greatest wish in life, a moment in the presence of the Biebs. This particular favor and another of greater significance would come due in 2016, to the enormous benefit not of me, but the political prospects of candidate Donald Trump. Not that Trump deserved the admiration and support of the devout folks he'd just met. Trump's true feelings about the encounter with the evangelicals and the laying on of hands, a supposedly sincere and pious summoning of the will of God, were revealed as I entered Trump's office at the end of the day to have a final recap of his thoughts on the laying on of hands ceremony. "Can you believe that bullshit?" Trump said with incredulity, referring to the ritual and the evangelicals. "Can you believe people believe that bullshit?" In the end, the real reason Trump didn't run in 2012 had nothing to do with prayer or otherworldly guidance. He was ruled by worldly concerns, specifically money. He was making multi-millions. Trump would often bag as much as $65 million for each season as the star of Celebrity Apprentice, and the producer Mark Burnett needed to know if Trump was going to sign up for the next season. Ratings were declining, but Trump was still making serious money, constituting a rare positive cash flow for the boss, with his other businesses not nearly as successful. And he said he wasn't going to just quit the show. "You don't leave Hollywood," Trump told me as he explained why he was dropping the presidential bid. "Hollywood leaves you." In the never-ending swirl of chaos at the Trump Organization, in the middle of helping Trump figure out if he was going to run for president, I was also pursuing a deal in the Eurasian country of Georgia on behalf of the boss. I'd been to Ukraine once in 2002 with my brother, but this was my first foray into doing business in the former Soviet Union, an experience that would morph over time into a national scandal, allegations of espionage, and my imprisonment. This proposed transaction was for Trump to sell his name and brand to a Georgian-American businessman I knew who was going to build hotels in the cities of Tbilisi and Batumi. My friend was connected to the CEO of a large Georgian company called Silk Road that would finance the deal, so it was decided I should travel to the country for a site inspection. I arrived to a military reception at the airport and a motorcade to the hotel, followed by a press conference with the media announcing that Donald Trump was coming to Georgia. This was my first glimpse of the power of the Trump brand in the former Soviet Union. I'd learned that Trump had a certain audience in the United States, mostly not at the higher levels of taste and society, but there were many who weren't attracted to his gaudy blend of wealth, braggadocio, and machismo. Not so in Georgia, not by a long shot. The more boorish elements of Trump's shtick were directly relatable to wealthy oligarchs ripping off the resources of their countries, as if he was a universal role model. Trump's lack of scruples and conspicuous consumption had long attracted Russian investors to buy into his condo projects in New York and Florida, using numbered companies to hide the true ownership of the properties. This dicey practice was hardly limited to the Trump Organization, though the boss displayed a strange obsession with Russia, as I'll discuss in due course, and the attitudes about foreign oligarchs and obviously corrupt officials from third world countries were extremely lax for the Trumps. Learning how entwined business and government were in Georgia, that evening I found myself having a private dinner with President Mikhail Saakashvili. In the morning, I was given the use of a military helicopter for the ride to Batumi, courtesy of the president, to look at a gorgeous 10-acre site on the Black Sea. The following day, to my amazement, I was summoned to the capital of Kazakhstan, where the prime minister pitched me on the idea of developing a $300 million Trump-branded hotel project in anticipation of a G7 summit that country was holding in 3 years. The Kazakh deal never came through, but it was another element of the pleasure of working for Trump. You never knew where you were going to go or who you were going to meet, and there was rarely a dull moment. For Trump, everything was ultimately about making money and obtaining power, and he could see that his presidential odds were getting longer by the day. At the time, he was also in the process of acquiring 2 golf courses in Ireland and another in Scotland, and he was concerned about what would happen to his various businesses if he turned his attention full-time to the 2012 campaign. A lot of the junky, fast-buck branding initiatives he'd gotten involved in, Trump Vodka, Trump Steaks, were starting to fail. Trump University was beginning to become a legal and publicity nightmare, with government investigations looming, and it was evident to me that I was going to be up to my neck in troubles that needed fixing. "The kids can't handle all of the businesses on their own," Trump finally said to me. "They're not ready for it." Then there was the inconvenient fact that Trump's poll numbers had tanked. As a rising reporter from Politico named Maggie Haberman, who was a friend of mine and would go on to cover me and Trump in the New York Times to this day, wrote, "The Donald went up, and then the Donald melted down." From the 26% number in April, Trump had played the birther story for millions of bucks in free press, as we'd anticipated, but Obama's release of his birth certificate had taken the wind out of the sails of that story. Trump's belligerence and refusal to let the matter drop weren't wearing well, it appeared. By May, he'd dropped to 8% and 5th place, tied with Ron Paul and far behind the eventual nominee Mitt Romney, which amounted to a slap in the face for the boss. Left unspoken was Trump's true appetite for a showdown with a politician as popular and talented as Barack Obama, no matter how much Trump boasted about defeating him. Fear was an emotion Trump would never admit to, but it struck me as more than a little convenient to snipe from the sidelines about birther conspiracies, but another thing altogether to step into the arena and face the withering wit and soaring rhetoric and the real danger of humiliation at the hands of the 44th President of the United States. "I swear to you we'll do this in 2015, Trump said to me privately as he prepared to announce he wasn't going to run at the upfronts to promote the following season of The Apprentice, a way to try to monetize what had clearly been a publicity stunt, or so it seemed to the world. "If you do this, we'll do it shoulder to shoulder," I replied. "I swear to you, I'll be at your side." "I know you will," Trump said.